Israel National Radio presents Walter's World. Exciting, inviting, intriguing, enlightening. News and interviews from Israel and the world. Walter's World.
Hello and welcome to the April 1906 edition of Walter's World. My name is Walter Bingham, back from my travels to England and the USA, and it's my pleasure to keep you company again for the next hour. To judge by your emails that met me on my return, the programs of earlier items which I compiled to broadcast during my absence were enjoyed by a great many listeners who missed them the first time round, and also by others who liked to hear them again. It's just days now before the celebration of Passover, the festival of remembrance and thanksgiving for the exodus of the Jews from slavery in Egypt. The special meal we eat on the first evenings of Passover, or Pesach, as is its Hebrew name, contains many symbolic items. I'm sure that some of our excellent programs will discuss their significance in detail. I happen to like eggs, and they too play a part. There's one displayed on the specially prepared ceremonial Seder plate. But most people also eat a hard-boiled egg during that special meal. I would like to hear what explanation you have for that custom, because there seem to be several. So please let me know, and I'll read out your emails in the next program. While on the subject of eggs, I'm always puzzled why the eggs I see in stores in the USA are marked large and yet compare only with the smallest anywhere else. Are American chickens programmed to lay two small ones rather than one large because it doubles the quantity and is more profitable? Perhaps you have a view on that one too. And now to some matters of substance. In the Jewish calendar, Pesach begins on the 21st day of the month of Nisan. Today is the 11th day of Nisan, which for many Jews is also a very significant date, because on this day in the Jewish year 5662, that's 104 years ago, the last, for the time being at any rate, of the Lubavitcher Rebbe's Menachem Mendel Schneerson Zichron Livracha was born. The Jewish people have been so heavily decimated that each of us must be made to count and count doubly. That was said after World War II by Rabbi Joseph Schneerson, the predecessor and father-in-law of the last Lubavitcher Rebbe, the late Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Zichron Livracha, and it seems to me that this suggestion or order, because it says must have been the inspiration of his son-in-law to devote his life, as my next guest recalls him saying repeatedly, and not to rest until every Jewish child, every Jewish person, was afforded a proper Jewish education to know how to live as a Jew and as a human being. So I thought it was an appropriate time to visit the world headquarters of Chabad Lubavitch at 770 Eastern Parkway, Brooklyn, New York. Most Jews have heard of Chabad Lubavitch, although they may not be familiar with the address, or know the name of the man who is in overall control of that movement since the death of the last Rebbe of Lubavitch. The man I'm referring to is my guest, Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, and I asked him first if it would be right to say that almost every Jew not only knows Lubavitch, but has in one way or another been touched by Lubavitch.
I believe that's an apt statement and description. We now have more than 2,700 divisions in 70 countries around the world, staffed by 10 to 12,000 men and women, as dedicated as one can be in outreaching to our brothers and sisters around the globe. And as a result of that ubiquitousness, it is safe to say that there is hardly a family in the Jewish world today, in any part of the world, that has not in some way been touched to some degree, in one way or another, by Chabad Lubavitch.
I'm not sure if I asked you that on a previous occasion, but yours is known as a Hasidic movement. By the way, you rebuked me once because I called it a sect. But what exactly does it mean to be Hasidic? Surely it can't be just a mode of dress.
It is certainly not. One does not have to have a black hat and a black coat and black shoes to be a Chassid. The Chassidic teachings, Chabad Chassidic teachings that I can speak for, as apart from other Chassidic groups, the teachings, the philosophy is sort of an inner light that illuminates the Torah in its exoteric sense. It is the esoteric life of Torah and its teachings, particularly in Chabad, aimed at giving the student, the Jew, the Jewess, the wherewithal, the hasbara, the explanation of Torah and the observance of its mitzvahs. And you, most of the time you'll find that a chosid has an inherent animation that doesn't necessarily exist in other quarters. It is not just intellectual, it's not arid. It is intellectual but very emotional as well. The term Chabad, which is synonymous with Lubavitch, is an acronym for Chochmah, Bina, and Das.
Which means?
Knowledge, understanding, wisdom. It's three different parts of the physiological intellect. It's physiologically true, and certainly in the thought process, which we won't go into now. But the objective is to understand. That's why it's referred to as Chabad, to understand the inner workings and feelings, the emotion of Torah, and transfer that understanding, that intellect, into an emotional attributes, so that when observes a mitzvah, he's not doing something distant from himself, just doing it by rote. He's actually experiencing a holy act.
Our listeners ought really to know with whom I'm speaking. You, probably better than anyone, know all about the movement. I think you've been here at this address since 1946, studying at the Central Yeshiva. Before you got your smicha, your rabbinic ordination, when did you join the staff of the Rebbe?
That was just after my marriage in 1957. I was approached by the Rebbe's chief of staff, Rabbi Chodakov, during the summer of 1956, actually, just about 3 or 4 weeks before my wedding date, which was shortly before Rosh Hashanah. And he asked me what my plans were for making a livelihood after my wedding, because I was just a yeshiva bacher. And I told him that I really had no plans. I was just at a yeshiva bocha, never had a job, never earned any money. My parents, God bless them, rest their souls.
Yeshiva bocha, that's a student of Jewish scriptures.
And I really had nothing in mind. I was wide open. And he sort of told me so cool-headedly that, how would you like to join the Rebbe's secretarial staff? And I thought I'd fall through the floor. That was the kind of an offer you couldn't really refuse. I was struck like a lightning bolt.
I can understand that.
But I accepted. And literally the day after my Sheva Brachas, I was in the Rebbe's office.
And then it didn't take long before you became one of his secretaries. When was that? And am I right that there were just two secretaries?
At that time, preceding my joining the office staff, there were four secretaries, actually.
What was it like to work for the Rebbe? I ask that because many people journeyed from across the oceans to see him and to get a blessing and just to be in his presence.
I would say that it was, in my case, personally, every moment of the 40 years that I had that zechut to be in the Rebbe's proximity, close proximity, was exciting. The work was varying to the degree that it covered every aspect, the whole kaleidoscope of life, of Jewish life, community life, personal life, here and around the world, from the very beginning. And every experience was fresh. You never got used to it. It wasn't something you got to do by rote, because everything was exciting, everything was adventurous, and it covered the whole, as I said, the whole kaleidoscope, the whole latitude of Jewish life, problems, good news that was not always so good, but you were totally enveloped in it, and it was really a life adventure of excitement and involvement, and totally immersed in what had to be done.
Did he ever give detailed instructions or just said what he wanted done?
You cannot classify the Rebbe's administration, as it were, for lack of a better word. Everything was expected of you. Sometimes he was very detailed, very microscopic, and sometimes it was just both makifi, in general terms, a job that had to get done, the results had to be such and such. and you did the best you could to achieve that.
You were also the spokesman for the Rebbe. Were you told by him or had to consult about the content of any public statements you made?
Of course. In that particular position of representing the Rebbe's public statements and pronouncements and appearances, it could not be done without his input.
In case you've just joined us, I'm in conversation with Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, who is the chairman of the worldwide organization of Chabad Lubavitch. Lubavitch doesn't just have one function. The organization consists of three or four different divisions. What are they, briefly please, and what are their functions?
Yes, there are three pillars, you may say, upon which the house of Lubavitch, of Chabad Lubavitch, stands. You have the Merkaz L'Inyoni Chinuch, which is the educational arm of the movement, which is concerned with all matters of Jewish education around the world.
Is that the part that sends out the emissaries?
Yes, the Merkaz L'Inyoni Chinuch is the agency responsible for all the Bote Chabad, the Chabad houses around the country, and campus and otherwise, and the staffs that work there, that administer the institutions, and it has a huge publishing house for all kinds of Jewish education literature in many, many languages, and schools of various and sundry nature all over the world, and all different languages, of course, in accordance with the particular country that the institutions are in. And it cares for all the children around the world, and as you mentioned before in the introduction, the Rebbe often said that we cannot rest until every Jewish child is assured a proper Jewish education. That's the function of the Merkaz L'Inyoni Chinuch in general terms. There is another organization known as Machne Israel, the Jewish camp, literally translated, which is the social services arm of the Lubavitch movement globally. And then there's Agudat Chassidei Chabad, which is sort of the collective of all Lubavitch followers, admirers, sympathizers around the world, and sort of sets the tone in the philosophical direction that the movement takes, which was, of course, said by the Rebbe himself.
You mentioned the publication house, the Kehort Publication Society, which claims to be the largest publisher of Jewish books worldwide. And you're its chairman. That alone must be a very daunting task.
It is a very pleasant task, sometimes daunting. It is very active, and we have different publishing houses around the world where the literature is published in the local indigenous language. And yes, it is a task, but we have very good people managing the various locations, the various plants around the world, and it is remarkable. The output is remarkable. The dissemination is remarkable and very successful. And I don't think it's daunting. I think we have it pretty well in hand.
Well, let me step back one. I think that some 4 years before his death, in 1990, the Rebbe appointed you to be his number two on a 6-man central committee. That too must have been daunting.
I think there's some misunderstanding there. I did have the privilege of being appointed by the Rebbe to be the secretary of the three institutions, corporations, they call them in America, that, as I said, were the three pillars that support the whole House of Lubavitch, the Merkaz L'Inyoni Chinuch and the Machne Yisrael, and Agudat Chassidei Chabad. I was appointed way, way back in the 70s to be secretary of each of the corporations in which the Rebbe was president. Rabbi Charukov, whose name I mentioned before, was vice president. And there was a Dr. Nissen Mendel, one of the Rebbe's secretaries, who was treasurer. There were just four offices, and I was privileged to be one of those four.
But then, after the Rebbe's death, which occurred on the 24th of June, 1994, you became chairman and effectively the head of the organization of all those corporations. It's not unusual in such organizations to have a lot of infighting when the top job falls vacant. And in this case, it fell vacant for the first time ever because the Rebbe left no precise instructions, nor did he groom anyone to take over. How did you cope?
We're still coping. It's not over. Of course, the word infighting is not an accurate description, but there are differences of opinion. I think there are no two people who look alike or think alike, the Talmud tells us, and everyone is entitled to their opinion in any given matter. And the organizations have committees that meet frequently to discuss the past, the present, and the future, to solve problems and to create new initiatives. And yes, there are differences of opinion, and I think that's very healthy. We deal with that in, you might say, a corporate way to an extent, but we ultimately hopefully make the right decisions.
So obviously you are exposed to a fair amount of criticisms from time to time. Is it lonely at the top?
To an extent it is. I don't have to say this at the top. I wouldn't qualify it that way.
Well, you are always a very modest man, I know.
Well, you're very kind. But criticism, yes, yes. To some extent, I'm a target for many of the critics and detractors of certain things, or Lubavitch in general, but that's fine. That's all in the day's work.
It must be difficult. I want to leave you alone on that subject. It must be difficult to be at the helm when, for instance, such a fundamental issue as the assertion that the Rebbe's Mashiach has still such a strong following.
I'm not sure of what it is and what the following is, but we get by that. I can just tell you, because it's not the world's best-kept secret, that we had a court case during the past year with regard to the premises of the synagogue that is part of the premises of the complex of the headquarters, and we won that case. There will be effect change, radical change, in that shul, in the shul that is at the main headquarters. And I think we're moving forward, and I know we're moving forward, and away from those things that are distractful and that are, to an extent, perhaps even destructive, in weeding it out and getting on with all the things that the Rebbe taught us to do, that he spent his life teaching us to do, and perpetuating to the best of our ability his design, his teachings, his deeply felt desire to disseminate Hasidic teachings, to disseminate Judaism, Yiddishkeit, in all its forms, amongst all Jews, regardless of who they are, background, wherever they're located, whatever language they speak. And we go forward with that, and that's where our thrust of our efforts are. That's what we concentrate on. And anything that is not in keeping with that aim, with that goal, simply falls by the wayside and has to be dealt with, and it will eventually be dealt with as it is being dealt with. But that should not be a distraction from what we want to do and to where we are headed.
I know that that subject of Mashiach is one that you don't really like to talk about. Would you like to speculate what their motives are?
I would not like to speculate, no.
Some people say that the Rebbe has more influence today after his death than he had during his lifetime. What do you think about that?
It's interesting to note that the Hasidic teachings and in the Tanya, in the third book of Tanya, Tanya has five books, in the third one, the Alter Rebbe, the author of the Tanya, Rabbi Shneur Zalman Abeladi, talks about tzaddikim. And after their passing, because the limitations of the body are removed, and the soul remains eternally, in a spiritual sense, in the spiritual realm, the tzaddikim are closer to their students, to the followers, than they were during the lifetime. And I remember when the previous Rebbe passed away in 1950, the Rebbe, son-in-law, would often talk about these chapters in Tanya that describe the afterlife of tzaddikim. And as young students at the time, we didn't realize why he was saying this. We had a Rebbe. We didn't seem to be lacking a Rebbe because we had one. And now, after 1994, after the Rebbe passed away, we understand it fully. And not only do we understand it now, but we feel it. You can actually feel, I don't think there's a shliach, an emissary, a representative of Chabad, amongst the many, many thousands around the world, men and women, who will not tell you that every instance of their lives, 24/7, they feel the Rebbe looking over their shoulder. And it's real. It's real. And the visitations by people from all over the world to the Rebbe's gravesite, he's interred next to his father-in-law, where he would visit in his lifetime thousands and thousands of times in the course of the years. People come now, and they pray, and they ask, beseech God for good health, for panasa, for all the things that, as humans, we wish for ourselves and for our families and for Klal Yisrael, for community, etc. And they will tell you stories about how the prayers were answered in matters that were beyond hope. It's incredulous. But we hear it every single day. We see it. We witness it every single day.
After the Rebbe's death, you, of course, had access to his papers, and you found some notes which, in part, have subsequently been published. What was that about?
Very interesting. The Rebbe did appoint me to be the sole executor of his estate. And after his passing, in going through some of the files, that had never been seen before. He found two black notebooks, each with about 400 pages in his own holy handwriting, that he wrote back in the 1930s and early 40s, when he was still in Europe, and some of it after he came to the United States. We call them the Rishimis, notes. And they cover a vast storehouse, treasure, of Jewish study and Jewish custom and tradition that no one had seen before. And in his inimitable way, how he explained when he would speak publicly after he became rabbi from 1950 to 1992, he always was able to talk about Torah passages and with Hasidic teachings as it is, to illuminate those teachings and bring life to something that would otherwise be just arid and intellectual. And the rabbi spoke at great, great length, usually. He was known to have marathon fabringens from 4, 5, 6, 7 hours, and even more than that on occasion, and quite frequently. And the things we found in those notes from the 30s and early 40s, he never made reference to later in his life. It was fresh. It was done in his younger years, and the genius that one sees, at that time he was wandering in Europe from one country to another. He didn't have a library, and his references to the sources of what he was writing about are so accurate, without having the books to check. It is actually a wonder of wonders to Torah scholars, presented so simplistically that it is astonishing.
Rabbi Kinsky, you mentioned before that there are thousands of emissaries around the world. Do you personally interview them for their suitability? And do they have to be married?
I'll answer the second question first. Yes, they have to be married. Unless they're just temporary going to help out another shliach for a holiday or for a summer camp, whatever it is. I don't interview them personally. That's humanly impossible. You must realize that when it started, they were sent out by the Rebbe, by Rabbi Charkov, in his time, say from 1955 or so up to 1970. Then it started getting ahead of steam and numbers started growing. They were interviewed by other people, sometimes by myself or others on the team at that time. And as it grows now, there are staffs of people who spend time with that.
Join me again after the news break for more from Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky of Chabad Lubavitch, who will talk about the commendable humanitarian work of that organization.
Israel National Radio presents Walter's World. Exciting, inviting, intriguing, enlightening news and interviews from Israel and the world. Walter's World.
Oh,
Welcome back. That was the great cantor Moshe Kusevitsky, Zichron Levracha, singing L'Dor V'Dor. Translated into English, it reads, "Throughout all generations we will declare your greatness, and to all eternity we will proclaim your holiness. Your praise, O our God, shall never depart from our mouth, for you are a great and holy God and King. Blessed are you, the Lord, the Holy God." And now, let's return to my conversation with Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky, who is the chairman and chief executive officer of the worldwide Chabad Lubavitch movement.
I'd like to talk for a moment about some of the work of some of the shluchim, if I may. And what we find is that when a shluch goes out to a specific community or city, country, whatever it is, they must be prepared to deal with everything. Everything, every aspect of life. In the past 14 to 15 months, the world has been smitten by tragedies of various nature. And I remember the tsunami that befell the Far East. There were people's lives who were affected, of course, in India and Thailand, and a whole slew of countries, of course. Its effect was felt very, very widely. And there were many Jewish people, tourists primarily, in these countries. There was no other Jewish agency or organization that could deal with this. In Bangkok, there were no synagogues. I don't believe the Israeli government had any base over there that could be used for searching for the missing and helping those who survived in all the ways that they have to survive. Neither did they have it in India. But we had people. We had people in those countries, in several cities in those countries. And inevitably, they had to roll up the sleeves and go out into the areas that were stricken and look for the Jewish people, deal with those who unfortunately had to be sent back to where they came from in a coffin. There were several, of course. And then deal with those who survived and those who came from other countries to help search for their families and friends. The Israeli government used the Chabad house in Bangkok as a base for all of their activities. And when Shabbos came, there were hundreds and hundreds of people had to be fed and observe Shabbos. It was all taken care of by the Lubavitcher Shluchim in Thailand, same thing in India and other places. And then we had a Katrina shortly after that. We had our Shluchim down in Louisiana and New Orleans primarily, and some cities around New Orleans, Missouri, etc. And they were themselves affected, and their communities were affected in total. And that had to be dealt with as well. There was crisis intervention on the part of Chabad, like nobody else, much more than FEMA, even more than the United States government. We had people in rowboats, rowing around in the floodwaters, in and around New Orleans, taking elderly Jewish people off of rooftops. They were afraid to go with anybody else. They saw Chabad, Lubavitch, then were going. Otherwise, they wouldn't leave the houses. And they were taken to refuge, and they were supplied with kosher food and all the things that they needed as human beings. They were taken to other cities. The children were put into day schools, Lubavitcher day schools in Texas and in schools in Tennessee. They were helped to settle in New Jersey and in other states of the Union. And it was a great cost. We raised a lot of money, but we spent more than what we raised. And it's still not over. We're still very much involved. Our shluchim are down in Louisiana, more than I can tell you in this brief interview. And then after Katrina, there was a Wilma that very few people remember suddenly. It was about a few weeks after Katrina hurricane. and that affected the central part of Florida, the central coastal area. We know, because we have over 105 institutions in the state of Florida alone, we know that there are many tired Jewish senior citizens in those cities and those areas that were affected. Many live in high-rise buildings. There was no electrical current, in some cases for 2 weeks, certainly for several days after the Wilma. And what do you do with a couple that's on the 10th floor of a building? They can't walk down because there's no elevator. They can't walk back if they did walk down. And they need medicine. They need food. Refrigerators are not working. And this has affected tens of thousands of Jewish people in Florida after the Katrina. People were sick and tired of the tragedies. People who were very, very generous and contributed to help in the search and rescue of the Katrina tragedy didn't come forward with regard to Wilma. But Lubavitch did. And scores of Ashluchim with hundreds of volunteers, sometimes boys and girls and married couples, we sent down from New York tens of thousands of meals that don't need refrigeration. There's a process when you open it, it heats up and it can stay for a very long time. It's not perishable. We bought tens of thousands of those meals. In fact, we got the factory to work day and night to package and provide those meals. We had some of our own people going to the factory to make sure that they could fill the orders. And these volunteers in Florida went to all the buildings, went up all the floors, knocked on all the doors, and made sure that everybody had what they needed.
This relief was Florida, but the relief for the tsunami, for instance, that was very far away, and the emissaries are charged to provide and find their own financial means. But that must have been such a big task. Did the headquarters help financially?
Of course it had to, but others came forward. It was a wide group effort. The Joint Distribution Committee, who had no offices, they came forth with some funding to help. And I think in all the instances, it was Lubavitch maybe that spearheaded the Jewish effort, but there was a lot of support behind it. There are stories that can be told about all these three tragedies. When Lubavitch is needed, it's ready, for no matter what.
Well, there's no answer to that except Kol HaKavod. It's really wonderful, and the world ought to know about that, because people throw all Hasidim into one pot and don't often distinguish between what Lubavitch does and what others don't do. You know, it's great to see Lubavitch becoming stronger and bigger by the week under your guidance, and it's been, as usual, a pleasure to heard you talk, and I look forward to many other conversations with you. May you continue at 120 until 120. Thank you very much, Rabbi Yehuda Krinsky.
Very kind, and I thank you. And since it is before Pesach, I want to wish all the listeners a Chag Kosher V'Sameach.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I thought you might like to hear a couple of typical Chabad Lubavitch Nigunim tunes that Hasidim sing when they get together to celebrate, to eat, and to talk Torah.
I want to tell you about something I saw on the internet, which I found to be one of the most innovative ideas I've come across for some time. I think I mentioned it before here, but it's worthwhile a reminder. www.godaven.com is an Orthodox minyan database, a prayer room database, giving details of prayers, services, and contact information for over 2,500 shuls worldwide and growing daily. Synagogues can easily submit information about their own local services through a form on the site, enabling their information to be immediately accessible to all. So, shuls benefit by having a free listing, which gives them a far greater circulation than their own local newsletter, and, most importantly, Jewish travelers are able to check in advance what religious services are available at their destination cities, enabling them to plan their itinerary accordingly. Additional features of the site provide links to articles discussing the laws of prayer and techniques for improving concentration during praying. Here is the address once more: www.godaven.com. I found the site most useful. And talking about prayer meetings, have you ever been high when praying? I have. But don't be alarmed, it's not about drugs or drink. Looking through the GoDaven website, I found what must be one of the highest minyans, that's prayer meetings, in the world, right here in Jerusalem. I don't mean above sea level, but in a building. If you can beat it, let me know. It's on the 15th floor of an office building in the heart of the city. I was looking for a shtiebel, a small prayer room. Instead, I found an office where the owner decided that every weekday at 1:45 in the afternoon, he opens his private office to anyone who wants to take part in the afternoon service. The beauty of this place is that while saying the prayers, one looks across and down on Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, through the very large windows. It's an uplifting experience.
With me is David Zwedner, who owns this office. It's called Comstock, and they manage money in commodities. But you know, I expected to see a shtiebel, some kind of prayer room. It isn't. It's just an ordinary office. In fact, Mr. Zwedner's private office, where he sits behind a large desk. And we are on the 15th floor. I must tell you, the view is phenomenal. And, of course, you can see Har HaBayit. Mr. Zwedner, what gave you the idea to have a Mincha Minyan here? That's a prayer meeting in the afternoons.
The best way to ensure that you don't miss davening, you have your own in-house Minyan. We started the Minyan, this was about 25 years ago. And a lot of people in the building came. And it's been going ever since, regularly. Year after year.
I can't ask if there are lots of Jews in this building, because we are, after all, in Jerusalem. It's a wonderful idea, because you are right in the center of town.
We're in the center of town, and actually a lot of people who come to the Minyan aren't necessarily from our building. They come from all around the area. It's a convenient time, it's 10 to 2, and we always have a Minyan.
Can you describe the exact location where we are?
Sure, we're corner of King George and Ben Yehuda, next to Hamashbir, in a building called Migdal Ha'ir, on the 15th floor, right in the center of Jerusalem, which is in the center of the world.
It's a very good idea to have a minyan in town, especially for business people and others who maybe don't go to pray regularly, but do it when they have Yahrzeit, and so they have an opportunity to say Kaddish here.
That's exactly why people come. they come to a convenient place where they can say Kaddish, and they know they have a general minion in the center of town whenever they want it.
It's been going for, you said, over 20 years, and I hope there'll be another over 20 years in it, and I hope I can take part for that period.
More than welcome. It's actually 25 years, and we hope to go for at least another 25 years.
Hater days, hater days, dear old Olive-Base days. Reading and writing, oi, aglick, to hug it the knuckles from teacher stick. Oh, I still remember that teacher's stick. I started hater at the ripe old age of 6. When Papa came up to me and he said, No, Maya, genug shein mit the marbles, pom pom pullave, run chips run, genug zu spielen blind man's bluff, it's time to go to hater. Ich will nicht gehen in hater, Papa, I cried. Nebuch, all my crying helped me just like Titan Bonkus. So Mama dressed me up like for Yom Kippur in my long black stockings, my high button shoes, my blue serge coat with the velvet collar, and my little jockey cap with the peak. All that was missing was the number on my back, because from what the kids on my block had told me about hater, I was going to jail. So Papa was ready for me, and I was ready for him. And off we marched to hater. Now my hater wasn't like the beautiful, wonderful Hebrew schools these kids got today. No, my hater was situated in the back of a shul on 105th Street, wedged between a mikveh and a sausage factory, strictly kosher, milchik fleishik. When I entered the room, it had an aroma like the Bubba's Tom. You know what I mean by the Bubba's Tom? Well, I'll tell you in plain English. It smelled like farfalta burricas. The teacher greeted us with a stale, herring breath of welcome, and he directed me to my desk, the one directly in front of his, so I shouldn't feel lonesome. And then we began the beginner's double talk. Komet salafo, komet space bo, a boo ba boo ba hee ah hee ha! And like this it went on all week, until finally Saturday. No hater. So what do you think Papa does? Takes me to shul, gives me a sitter, and he says, No, already you've loined for a week, daven. So for the next 3 hours, a boo-booed, hoo-hooed, hee-had, and tata kveld. I was learning my lessons, and believe me, with my teacher, Reb Nussbaum, you either learned your lessons or you became a cripple. And this went on for years, learning, crippling, crippling, learning. Between scripture and fracture, finally came the day of my bar mitzvah. Ah, I was in heaven. This was the day of my parole. The shul was packed. With who? My mishpacha, that's who. Except there in the front row was Reb Nussbaum. When it came time for me to read my Haftorah, he coached me from the first row. Now we both gave my bar mitzvah speech. That evening at the reception, everybody gave me presents. Everybody but Reb Nussbaum. He was waiting for his. So I gave it to him. A pair of handcuffs. But Tata will give you a cup of knack. And don't be a yold buvan, you gotch. The new chains are cracking with the monkey nuts. So stop hit the spitball, spit at the gum. Or ice box invest to a bomb.
You know, I just came across this disc called Yiddish Mambo. And this track brought back vivid memories of my own earliest days in cheder. My knuckles were also red and blue, and did Reb Pesach Pak know how to aim. I'll leave you with a little more of this amusing CD. But that's the end for today. Next Sunday's program will be during Passover and features recorded highlights of the best of Walter's world. I'll be back again live on the 23rd of April with more from my recent trip. So until then, this is Walter Bingham wishing you Chag Pesach Kosher V'Sameach. Have a good and kosher Pesach. And remember the words in the story we recite at the Seder table. Let all who are hungry come and eat with us. Let all who are in need share our meal. Goodbye.
Ah, summertime! Oh, what a beautiful day! I'm so glad I got a reservation by Ichimaya's Hawaiian Hacienda in the Catskills. I wonder if I should start the day by taking a golf lesson from the pro or a dance lesson from the instructor, Jose Ginsburg. Or do I just take it easy and go boating or bathing?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The main dining room is now open. Everybody, please come in for breakfast.
Oi, it's time for breakfast? You get Essen, Essen. Hey, waiter, come here. Give me orange juice and prune juice, tomato juice, pineapple juice, and baked apples, two figs, two prunes, and appetizers. Essen, 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 Essen. Stay
salmon, smoked salmon, herring as a light. If they speckled herring, plain herring, matches herring, baked herring, fast cooking herring, and oatmeal and creamer, wheat, wheatine, and cornflakes, all bran and Wheaties, Cheerios and grape nuts and puffed rice, rice, crispy shredded wheat, and breakfast food of champions. Boiled eggs, scrambled eggs, fried eggs, poached eggs, waiters eggs, plain omelette, onion omelette, jelly omelette, tomato omelette, mushroom omelette, griddled cakes and rolls, assorted rolls and fried toast and buttered toast and French toast and griddled cakes and syrup, strawberry jam and marmalade and coffee, milk and tea and cocoa juice and buttermilk. Ken Hora, that's some breakfast. I wonder if I could find the egg cookie.